Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm ready.
Start the theme.
Oh, yeah.
Typical disgusting display.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Typical disgusting display.
And it starts right now.
Oh, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, Yemen's most popular podcast, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. And we're going to talk to Matt Golditch, writer, comedian today. We're excited. He writes for Seth Meyers, our buddy. So we're going to get into it with him because I think we have a lot of common experiences. Goldie, you had something you wanted to share with us this morning.
Yeah. So have either of you ever had a good night's sleep?
No.
Okay.
Never.
I've never had one. I've never woken up and just said, like, that was enough. I feel great. I'm ready to start. Never once. Okay.
Never.
Put that to the side.
Okay.
I have never had a good dream in my life.
First joke of the day.
Not once.
First joke of the day.
A good dream.
Never once. People say sweet dreams. I have never had a sweet dream. I've never had a wet dream. I've never gotten to ejaculate. I've had a dream that I was going to have sex and didn't have a condom and then it couldn't happen. That's a dream I had. So I just want to talk for a second about in the last 2 weeks, the dreams I have had, because I don't, basically you go to sleep at night and then you kind of safely go insane. So here are my dreams that I have had in the last 2 weeks. And again, people say sweet dreams. First, a guy pissed on my face. That was a dream. Someone just pissed on my face. Like I was waiting in line and then they turned around, they pissed on my face. And I was like, oh.
That's kind of a wet dream.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very good.
Very good.
Second dream is that there was a work event. It wasn't work. And I had to take a shit. There was no toilet. And so I had to, while everyone was kind of close proximity, go to a separate room and quietly shit in a pink paper bag.
Pink.
That
wow,
was a dream
so
I
much
had.
Symbolism here.
That
oh,
I,
wow.
Okay. So then I wait, you know, and then you wake up and you just go, oh, thank God that wasn't real. Or like, did that happen? And that's why I dreamed about it. So then another dream I had, I go, okay, I want to have a good dream. I accidentally left the water on in my garage. I caught it and I turned off and there was like an inch of water. And then I used a broom to push the water out in the street. Someone died in the flood.
Oh, my God.
So,
wow.
What? Like, I'm not flying. I'm not, like, meeting angels and mythical creatures. I'm not, like, winning an NBA championship. I'm not having a friendly encounter with aliens. I'm not seeing dead relatives who are saying comforting things to me.
Right.
I'm getting fucking pissed on, shitting at work,
in pink
and
bags.
Accidentally murdering people. What is fucking happening?
Oh, God. Well, Goldie, I have a couple. Well, first of all, it sounds like you, because of your not great sleep, like sometimes when I have a bad dream and you wake up, it's a great feeling because you realize, oh, thank fucking God that was a dream. And I'm not actually like face to face with some horrible ex or something.
Sure. But that's like surgery going well. Like it would be better to not have needed it.
True. Right. True. But here's the thing. And I feel like I know the answer ahead of time. Have you ever taken or would you consider taking like a CBD gummy for bed?
Oh, I've taken one.
And so how was that negative?
So panicked when I woke up that I had to go on the roof and look at the moon.
That was the effect, the calming effect of CBD for you.
Thought I was dying, didn't know how to breathe, was asphyxiating, like I was being strangled, and had to look at the moon for 45 minutes from the roof.
Oh, wow. Do you see? Because I feel blessed, and I hate that word.
Must be nice.
But I take a gummy before bed, and also after lunch, and before lunch, and after breakfast. But that's fine. But so I take one before bed, and I don't remember my dreams, and I have a great sleep. I'm out for like 8 hours, and it
But I think this is hereditary because my youngest kid, for a while, didn't want to go to bed because she said, I have none dreams or bad dreams.
Oh, wow. Yes. She's you.
Yeah. I know. It sucks.
I remember being like 7 and just sobbing because I couldn't go to sleep. Like waking up and my mom's like, why are you crying? I'm like, because I can't sleep. Like I've never
had. No, God, I feel so lucky that I've never really had problems with sleep. But the recurring nightmare that I had as a kid was even okay. Because my recurring nightmare, and my sister tells this, like that after we would watch The Muppet Show, which was like the greatest thing going at that time.
Totally.
I would have this dream that wooden arms with white gloves would come out of the wall and tickle me while I was sleeping. And like my sister, who is, we shared a wall, would say like, I could hear you laughing in your sleep last night. And I was like, I had that dream again. But that was
a terrible dream.
That's as bad as it got for me.
What? The earliest dream I can remember was, do you remember the show T.J. Hooker?
Of course. I've seen every episode.
Okay. I got in a car with T.J. Hooker and then he took off his glasses, which he didn't wear in the show. And then the back of his glasses was a knife and he stabbed me in the stomach.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. That's awful.
Yeah.
And what's even worse about that is it just so happens because I happen to be very into T.J. Hooker. It's
a
terrible show. But I just found out the other day that Shatner was 51 when the show started.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Wow. So that's us. We're T.J. Hooker's age now. Yeah. Extra depressing. Oh my God. Well, I'm Goldie. I'm so sorry because there's nothing worse than just sleep that doesn't get you refreshed or not the right amount of sleep.
I've never been refreshed. Never once.
Well, I'm gonna keep trying to think of something, but the CBD gummy was really my best.
You know what? I'll try a CBD again.
But I don't want you to wake up not knowing how to breathe because I know you do that. I know that's your reaction to like marijuana.
But now I'm able to be calm through that because I'm like, it's just your thing where you feel like you're gonna die.
No,
that's just that old thing again.
Yeah. Well, but if I have a good dream, I'll let you know.
Yeah, please let us update us on the podcast.
Yeah, like Martin Luther King, he had a nice dream.
Yes, he did. You'll have.
So
one
when I first heard that speech, he's like, I had a dream. I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Oh wait, his was okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. Well, first of all, climbing to that mountaintop would have been a nightmare for me, but he had a nice dream. All right, something that's a bad dream for us every week is Johnny jokes.
Okay, you guys remember that Matt's joining for Johnny?
I do. I'm very excited.
Yeah, is that what
we're
doing first, or what are we doing?
Yeah, we should
do that.
Let's get that out of the way.
That's like showing our dicks first. So in the locker room.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping
dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right. Well, folks, friends, we're here today with a writer and comedian who has guts, who has courage. And I say that about the very select few who agree to do Johnny jokes with us. Matt Goldich is here today, and he's going to do them with us. So without further ado, let's get in to Johnny jokes.
Whoa! From Hollywood in New York City, here. Here's Johnny's.
All right, here we go. Three rounds of Johnny's today, so let's hustle through them. Here we go. Vladimir Putin has reportedly found love with a 39-year-old woman whose job is censoring online criticism of the Russian leader. The two hope to spend more quality time together, but she is so busy at work. All right, lucky start there. Jordan Spieth, golfer Jordan Spieth, was disqualified from the Genesis Open last week after he signed a wrong score on his card. Stunned tournament organizers were left Spiethless.
I knew it was either going to be Spieth or there was something in the air tonight, or a studio Genesis.
I knew it was going one of two ways.
Yeah, you should have just stopped at Spiethless. I go one level deep. Greece has officially legalized same-sex marriage. Experts feel this is great news for Zuko and Kaniki. Zuko and Kaniki from the show Grease. Okay. And finally for me, thank God, industry insiders are reporting that Paramount Plus and Peacock may be merging into one streaming service. Well, that could be fun. Coming home and asking the missus if she wants to mount cock and chill. Johnny All Two, right. Get me out All of right. this.
Well, here we go. This week, Donald Trump unveiled a new line of sneakers. Wow. Imagine being able to run as fast and jump as high as Donald Trump. Get in line. The shoes feature his exclusive no money back guarantee. Trump says the shoes are perfect for any court. Basketball, tennis, legal.
Yeah.
And if you normally wear a 10, order a 5 because the sizes are inflated.
Yes.
Trump says if you want a pair, just go online, place your order in your cart. Don't worry about entering your credit card. Mexico will pay for them.
Yeah. Wow. Good run.
Yeah.
Wow. Good run.
Also nice. Last week, Donald Trump was ordered to pay over $350 million for fraudulently overstating his worth to banks. Trump complains the giant settlement has left him without a diaper to piss in. Walmart.
Wow.
You saw this. Walmart, giant retailer, is buying the TV manufacturer Vizio. Walmart will spend the first week excited, then the next 3 years wishing they just bought Sony. And lastly, Tiger Woods has unveiled a new line of fashion. Ooh. Tiger's clothes are perfect whether you're in the office, on the golf course, or just casually crashing your car.
Yeah. We got there. Johnny Three.
Okay, here we go. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Everybody's yes. Ready.
Okay. President Biden told reporters recently that President Biden told reporters recently he is pushing for a pause in the fighting between Israel and Hamas for about 6 weeks. 6 weeks, or about as long as it takes him to walk to the podium.
Not young.
Keeping with the Biden, the White House. Yeah. The White House hosted an event recently in honor of Black History Month for descendants of civil rights leaders like Booker T. Washington and Malcolm X. That's right. They met with Malcolm XI and Malcolm XII.
Good hold. Good hold. Yeah.
In sports news, the Orlando Magic recently retired Shaquille O'Neal's number 32 jersey. So now no other Magic player is allowed to shoot that free throw percentage. Okay. And finally,
yeah.
Lawmakers in West Virginia are considering a new bill that would fine adults for smoking in a car with children. So if the cops catch you, just hand the cigarette to your kid. I swear, officer, it was his. Thank you.
Excellent. Wow. That feels good. I love it. Yeah. I love it when writers come and join us
Those are
doing
great.
That. So
it
all right,
just goes to show these jokes don't change much over time. They don't change as much as you think.
Right. Yeah. What worked for Carson will work today.
Will you give those jokes to your boss, Seth Meyers?
Oh, he already turned him down.
We got the reject.
I wasn't going to write new jokes for you guys.
The reject. I love it. I love it.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
So yeah, we'll get into our good friend Seth Meyers. We've talked to him on here before. So
I listened to the episode, yes.
Yeah did he mention you?
No, sadly. He did mention me on Howard Stern, which was very exciting when he was on Stern. Stern said that he liked one of my jokes that I wrote, and Seth explained to him why it was bad, which was a huge thrill. Because we do this segment called I was actually shocked at how much Stern watches the show, because most people just watch the closer look and that's it.
Yeah.
But Stern knew the segment, the surprise inspection segment, where Seth basically trashes us for our horrible jokes that we write.
Yeah,
and he brought up a joke that I had written, and he said, "Now I think that's a good joke. Explain to me why that's bad." And Seth explained why it was bad.
So that's when you get mentioned.
I know.
Yes, exactly. But I was like, "Hey, I did well. I did one for." I was like, "I know Seth likes me enough to let me keep the job, so I'm not in trouble with him. That's fine." So if I had to take one to compliment my joke out of the two, I would rather have Howard do it, right? Because that's sort of a little extra something. Right?
I once wrote a joke for Craig Kilborn that made him so angry that he was like, on air, he was like, "Where's Goldie? Where's Goldie? Can we bring him out?" And I hid so they couldn't find me. So I didn't have to come out, but he was really mad. He was genuinely mad.
What was it? Because it was bad, or why?
It was a 5 questions with John Cleese, and one of the questions was,
"Oh no,
do you mind if I call you Stretch?" And then, the next 3 questions involved his nickname being Stretch, but it didn't land, and it just got worse and worse. And he was like, "Get Goldie out here. Why would we call him Stretch?" And I just knew that, I knew that he'd be mad if he couldn't find me, but he would be madder
if he
had to then spend time engaging with me.
Right.
As I explained why I thought it was funny to call John Cleese Stretch.
Yeah. Had he not approved any of that beforehand, or?
I had talked him into it.
Yeah, exactly.
I had talked him into it. He didn't want to do it. And I said, "No, it'll be funny." It wasn't.
I love that. We three have this in common, and Matt, you're doing it now. And we didn't even give you the proper intro. We're talking with writer, comedian extraordinaire, Matt Goldich, who is currently a writer on Late Night with Seth Meyers and has been for some years. at the top of his game. So we're thrilled to have you here with us. But this is something that the three of us have in common, is working in not only late night, but the worst spot in late night, like the later hour.
I would say the best spot.
Yeah.
Well, you have more, you have a little more freedom. Yeah. You can kind of just throw shit out there like Stretch and see if it sticks. But I loved that about Craig, like, and Goldie, we've talked about this several times. Goldie, not Golditch. That watching Craig get angry about the comedy you present to him was so hilarious. Like, it gave me the church giggles, you know, like I just would uncontrollably laugh when he hated something that we had talked him into. So I get that. Now, Matt, for Seth Meyers, you know, actually he got kind of annoyed when I called him, I forget what, like affable or, you know,
something. Yeah, the first thing affable. You did.
Yeah, the first thing I did as I called him, I don't think it was affable, but it was a word like that. And I think he's so sick of hearing that, which I get. But he does come, he is an incredibly likable guy. Like you just, you know, when you look at him, and is there another side to it? Like working on the show where he can get frustrated in the way that like a Craig Kilborn or Craig Ferguson or Letterman or those kind of people, or does he pretty much maintain like this, like nice, pleasant demeanor?
He's so normal that it is off-putting, I would say.
Yes.
It's like a 10 years, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop and it never happens. But no, he's, I mean, not only a super nice guy to work for, great boss, but also often and almost always the best writer in the room. So
yep.
Instead of being the person who say, you know, I don't like this, is the person who said, can say, you know, I'll fix this or I'll make this better or I'll change it myself. But and for sure, a straight shooter, you know, if something is not good or if you pitch something and he doesn't like it, it's you know, he's not going to do it anyway just to make you feel good. I mean, right, it's still right. TV. You still have right. to do the things that you think are funny, but for sure is like very open and honest and just in general, you know, a great guy to work for sure.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. I mean, that's kind of what you feel from him when you watch him perform, whether it was back on SNL or now on the late night show. But so let's go back a little bit before that, because that's not your only experience in late night. You were on Letterman for a time, correct?
I did. I worked there for a year. That was my first. So I had written on, you know, various cable shows, countdowns, game shows.
Spike you know, the TV. Sort of, Spike
yes,
TV.
Oh, for sure. Spike
and
TV.
And
you were
a stand-up, I'm guessing, and then you...
Yes.
So
yes.
Stand-up came first and then writing.
And I think we may have even crossed paths in the stand-up world in New York when you were here. At least you, Goldie, right? A little
briefly.
Bit.
I mean, when did you start?
So I moved to New York in 2001 out of college, and I was my first job. I was actually a page at NBC in the same building where I work now.
I was a page as well. Yeah.
Yeah, in New York.
Yep.
Yeah. What
96.
Year was that? That yeah. So I was there.
96.
I started it as
I
a page. Great.
It.
Yeah. I mean, I also started at such a weird time. I started in August of 2001.
Yes. Oh, boy. Very weird.
Yeah, 3 weeks into my term as a page that, you know, that 9/11 happened and they canceled all of the tours. Right. And then after weeks, we finally come back into the building. And I think like the first or second day tours were back up, someone sent Tom Brokaw Anthrax. And so they were like, all right, we're canceling the tours again. We're canceling the tours again. So it was a weird time. I mean,
so were you working in the store or were you like assigned to a show or
we were it was the ticket office. You would sit in the office and you were like taking ticket requests for Conan and I think it was Rosie O'Donnell at the time. Yeah. And then eventually I got assigned to, you know, the real glamour jobs were Conan desk and SNL desk.
Yep. I had SNL desk.
See, now that was the glamour job. I got Conan audience and SNL audience, which was the non-glamour job. You were not dealing with any talent or production staff. You were dealing with the audience members, the riffraff. But the plus side, the upside was you got to watch every taping of Conan and every taping of SNL in the studio.
Yeah.
And, You got to get your friends tickets, which was fun. And for SNL, you could go to you went to the taping, and you were not allowed to go to the after party, but you were allowed to go to the after party.
Yes,
so if you could find somewhere to hang out for 3+ hours between the end of the show from 1 to when the after party started at 4:30, you could go. Now, I almost never went because even at age 21, I was like, I'm not staying up till 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah. Can I interject here for a second? Because I hated being a page.
Yeah.
I thought people were largely monstrous to me. I was at the desk. I would say the audience coordinator might have been better than the SNL page desk, because while some people were nice, others were monsters.
Yeah. Imagine that.
Just didn't like it at all. I was invited to the after parties, went a couple times. Of course, you're like the lowest rung on the ladder. People treat you like shit at the after party. So I have no good memories of that. I was giving tours, and the person, once someone didn't show up for a tour, and I was like, okay, they're in a bind, I'll take this tour. And it was that situation where every studio was closed because it's a live work environment.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't able to go, here's Conan, here's SNL. So the people complained about the tour because they didn't get to see much. And then I got reprimanded for something beyond my control. I got screamed at when I had taken a tour that I was on my lunch hour just because and so I fucking hate the page program. I just want to say that.
Yeah. When you're at a low level job like that, it is very hard to separate. People don't treat you well, and then they say things like you have a bad attitude, and you're like, but it does give you a bad attitude.
Yeah.
Because they're
not making
it up.
I didn't when I got here.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I mean, it sours you, and then if with every job I've ever had, I mean, I've been fired a lot, but there's always the version where it's their fault, they were assholes, they treated me like shit, and then there's always the things that I could have done differently where I'm like, oh, if only I had done that. You know, there's always that version of it, and it's the same. I mean, the page program, I did make it to the end, I think, or at least so it was a mixed experience for me. I made some good friends, but it didn't really launch anything for me, I wouldn't say.
Yeah. No, it can only launch something if you want to be in ad sales or some sort of news.
Exactly. Corporate communications
production.
Or something.
Yeah. Like if you want to be some NBC mid-level executive person who wears Banana Republic shirts and survives rounds
hilarious.
Of layoffs by by undermining people above and below you.
Wow, you've got this all figured out, mapped out here.
It sounds like you saw a lot. It sounds like you really
did.
You actually
I did. I mean, the people who worked for Lorne Michaels were genuinely, not all of them, but some of them were super mean to me in a way I've never forgotten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I could name them. I know who you're talking about.
Me too. Yeah.
Because we were all there at the same time. I mean, not all. Goldie and I were there at the same time. I was an intern at SNL, and then a year after that, writer's assistant. But the year that I was interning, they had me working the door of the SNL parties with another young guy.
That's the security you want.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get the stoned, long haired guy.
You had like, long hair? Awesome.
Oh, very long hair at the time.
What?
Yeah. Glorious, luxurious long hair.
You know, now that you remind me, I did have one experience at the final SNL after party of the year. I remember it was the first one. And this is, I was invited to the party because I'd worked the audience for every show that year. And I was invited as a guest to the party. And then later they said, every page actually has to work the party. And my invite was rescinded. And I was told I had to work it, which, I don't know if power move or just, oversight.
Par for the course.
So it must be a sense of triumph, though, to be back in the building and walk past all that and now be working on a show.
You must be nice to everyone, though, right? Because of
it. It is. I mean, yeah, I try as much as possible to. I would say it's generally a very nice environment to work in. Hopefully the pages feel that way, that they're being treated nicely. It was a long circuitous route because it was, I ended as a page in 2002 and then I came back in the building and started Seth 12 years later, 2014. So, there was stand up entry level writing jobs, best week ever on VH1, the original version.
Were you paneling or were you writing stuff for
Michael
Ian Black and those people?
I was writing for the panelists, selecting jokes that the panelists made. And then in the middle of my time there, they made a switch where they decided to change the format of the show from various panelists to a single host show hosted by Paul F. Tompkins, who was hilarious.
Yes.
But this was at a time where people still, you know, watched linear TV, and they didn't really give the audience any warning that they were changing the format of the show. And it aired after For the Love of Ray J's reality show, which was a pretty jarring transition, I think, for the audience from Ray J to Paul F. Tompkins. It was very poorly handled. They really did not give it any chance to succeed. And I think people were kind of furious that the old way was gone, even though everybody loved Paul and thought he was hilarious. But that was the job that got me when the switch happened to Paul Tompkins. The show's writing staff joined the union, joined the Writers Guild. And it was at a Writers Guild stand-up event that I met Bill Sheft, who was a longtime writer at Letterman.
Yeah.
Started communicating with him over email, mostly just emailing back random sports trivia questions. And then finally got up the courage to start sending him freelance jokes. I had been sending him freelance jokes to a couple other shows at the time. And that was how I got hired, ended up at Letterman. I sent some jokes to Letterman.
That's great.
Were you doing monologue, or were you doing monologue and sketch?
I have always been monologue. I've never trained in sketch. I've never learned how to write sketches. Any sketches I wrote were awful. Now I've been at Seth for almost 10 years, and just through osmosis and hanging out with people who are brilliant sketch writers and trying and failing, I have written and gotten sketches and other bits in the show. And that's one of the fun things about our show is, even though I'm a monologue writer, I do get to do other things. But I was a monologue writer on Letterman, sure, for a year, and maybe got one or two other bits in, but very short. I mean, if this was at a time later in the show where he wasn't really doing a ton of other
bits.
I mean,
did you meet him? Because I know famously, like, people would work there years and not see him.
I met him once for 30 seconds.
Wow.
It was very nice. Said thank you. And it was only because Bill went out of my way to introduce me to him. Or went out of his way. It was like, you should meet Dave. It was later in the show. It was also, you know, at that point, the show had been on a long time and it was very set in its ways. And I think the other, you know, odd thing was I did like Dave and I watched Dave, but I was younger and Conan was really my guy.
Yeah.
And so when I got started working there, people go, oh, you must have your dream job. This is so exciting. I go, you know, I like Dave. I like Letterman. I'm happy it's worked. He's a legend. It worked out that I got this great job. But and I certainly, you know, got some jokes on that I liked and stuff. But it was hard. It was a hard, you know, it was a year, but it was hard.
Yeah, of course.
And I think I know the answer to this question because you just sort of alluded to it. But is the environment for you at Seth Meyers different? Like, how is it different for the writers of Letterman and Seth Meyers? Like, what makes Seth Meyers kind of a more welcoming place?
Well, for one thing, I've met him at least twice.
Right. Double.
So that would be, no, I see him every day. I interact with him every day. You know, you're more, you feel more engaged in what's going on in the show. You know, you have, feel like you have a stake in it. You want it to do well. There were at Letterman a couple of writers, people like Joe Grossman, who would have an on-air presence, but not to the extent that we did. I mean, Seth really came from that Weekend Update background where, you know, you bring on, you know, people, you bring on guests, right. You're interacting with people, and he sees his writers as sort of cast members. And so we've all gotten to be in stuff on the show, and that gives us a real sense of pride and, you know, wanting to do well. And I've gotten to perform stand up on the show twice, which has been fun. I mean, we really feel more, you feel more like part of the team. And then also beyond that, Letterman, when I started there, the show, you know, he'd been on the air for 20 some years. You know, he'd been doing that show on CBS for 17 years. Now, Seth, I started 4 months after the show started. So I really was there for the formation of what the show is. And so I've
someone
been there.
Got fired. Four months. No, that's the
no,
13 weeks.
Actually, that's that. I, you know what? Normally, you would be 100% right. No, I was the first writer. The whole original staff was still there.
Okay.
And I was the first writer that was added to the staff after the show already started. I think what they realized is they were short a monologue writer. And so they put out a call. Thank God, because I had submitted a packet when Seth originally went on the air that was, you know, sketches and guest bits, ideas, things I was not a specialist in. Now, when the packet went out, they said, we just need someone to submit 15 monologue jokes. And I was like, now you're talking. Now this is my area of expertise. So, and I had a friend, a great, hilarious writer by the name of Andrew Law, who I'd worked with at the Jeselnik Offensive in L.A. when I lived there. And he was a writer at Seth, an original writer, brilliant writer. And I sent him literally like 100 jokes. And I remember he picked 15 and he said, these are the 15 you should submit. And I submitted those 15. Cool. And I got an interview and got hired literally to focus on monologue and later got to pitch and do other things, which was exciting.
Was it weird the first time you met him that you guys look kind of alike?
People have commented on that.
I can see that.
Especially since the special came out, people have commented on the fact that, you know, oh, I must have gotten my, you know, whole persona from him or things like that.
What?
But we do. I think it's. It's probably why I've survived 10 years, right? The fact that I have a similar voice and a similar, I think, style to him. I think it's maybe helped out, but yes. By the way, I also got that when I worked at Ellen. So
I was going to ask you who else you get mistaken for, because you do have this look where you kind of look like a few people.
Yeah,
you could talented Mr. Ripley a lot.
I know, like I'm seeing Mark Maron. Yeah,
you could Maron a little
Mark
bit.
Maron. There's a British comedian I'm not too familiar with named Louis Theroux that people bring up a lot.
I get that too.
John Lennon, older Asian women tend to say John Lennon a lot. I've gotten different people, but anytime it's a goy, I'm thrilled. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, that's a win for us. That's a win
exactly.
for us.
Yeah.
We'll take it. Yeah, it's funny. People have sent me photos of Louis Theroux as well, who I hadn't heard of until I started getting these pictures, and they're like, oh, you look just like him. And I think we can gather what the similarity is there.
I've only seen pictures. I'm not really familiar with much of his comedy, but
well, he looks like us apparently, or we look like him. I think he's a little older than we are.
So when you wind up on air on Seth, is that something that like has to come from him normally, like he says? Because it's weird, isn't it? Weird. I always found I would play this weird kind of game of chicken on Kilborn where it's like, I did like being on air, but I didn't like the show I wanted to be on air because then you're too ambitious. And so then it kind of had to come from Craig or someone, like maybe Goldie could do this. And then I would kind of do this dance where I'd go, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty busy with my writing. Goldie has to
don't
come on and
sing.
Be like, okay, guys, if you want me to come on, I'll come on.
Yeah.
And then I would do it. But of course, the whole time I was like, please put me on.
I go through phase. I mean, I'm pretty minimal with putting myself in things. I mean, part of the reason is I really cannot play characters that are more than like an inch away from myself. I mean, I'm not there. We have a very talented a group of sketch performers who can do that. And I'm not one of those people. I can basically play a version of myself. And so people have a couple times have cast me as versions of myself. The one real recurring character I had was a conservative character, where I play in this sketch called The Conservative Perspective, where I played a conservative pundit who would sort of make fun of Seth for being liberal. And we did that 4 or 5 times. And then, you know, there a couple times there used to be a segment where Seth would bring on the monologue writers to defend their jokes and explain them why they were funny. And then later that switched to him just showing our pictures and making fun of us because I think we were milking it too much. But then I started milking it again because I started showing up in the studio when he would make fun of me and then they would cut to me, which was fun. And then I've been lucky enough to do stand up twice on the show, which both were times when I had something coming out that I wanted to promote and they were nice enough. And again, like I waited 6.5 years between the two because I'm just like, I don't want to be the guy who's constantly asking for favors or for things. So
that's cool how that works. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up outside Philly. So I'm a Philly sports fan and I have Philly pride, but I've never lived in the city as an adult past high school. So my parents still have a place in the suburbs, but I, you know, people ask me about the geography of things or where things are, and I'm completely clueless, even though I have, you know, 12 pieces of Eagles gear. It's an odd, you know.
I think Goldie and I are that way about Boston a little bit.
Yeah, and I never really did. I later went back and did a little stand-up there, but I didn't start in stand-up there.
You moved to New York and when you turned 18?
I did a little bit in college. I went to Brown in Providence and I did some stand-up there. And then in New York, I mean, it was for the first year, it was just bringer shows. That was actually one nice thing about the Page program was there were 50 people who wanted to go out like 7 nights a week. Right. And so if you were doing a bringer show at Caroline's where you had to bring 20 people to get on stage, you actually could get, you know, between them and my college friends who had moved to the city, it actually was doable, you know? So yeah, it was, cool. And bringer shows, which get a horrible rap, obviously, for being a scam, which they are, but they do give you confidence when you're starting out as a stand-up because there's sort of a built-in big audience of people who are excited to see you, which is,
I just want to explain them to the audience because a lot of people may not know what this is. So basically what is a bringer show is, you're a starting comic. You go to see comedy and you assume everyone there is a professional comic, which is not true. A lot of times what happens is there are certain people who the club owner manager will say, if you can get 10 paying customers, we'll give you 10 minutes and they're buying drinks or whatever. So there are people who are just very bad comics who are somehow very good at convincing other people to see comedy shows and they're able to get a lot of spots out of this. I always found it mortifying.
Bring your friends or to what was
to
mortifying?
Ask people to spend money to see me.
Yep.
Well, yes. Although as a starting comic, here are your choices, right? And the bringer is the least mortifying of the choices. Because the other choice is A, open mics, which are horrible. They are, you know, it's just literally a bunch of comics in a room, nobody laughing. It ruins your confidence. You have to sit there for hours and hours. The other choice is barking on the street where you have to hand out flyers and get strangers to come in, which I did it. Like, there was a Turkish restaurant I used to perform at in Times Square. We had to bark people in. And the only reason I ever did it was because there were certain ones where you had to bark a certain number of people in, but this one was by the hour where they would go, if you bark for an hour, you can do the show. So I would go out there, bark for 5 minutes, and then I would go hide in the Virgin Megastore for 45 minutes and then bark again for the last 5. And I was like, I barked for an hour, you know, and that was how I got
ran
on stage.
The same scam. I mean, did you then did you try to get past at club? Like, what's been your experience with clubs in New York? Are you a regular at any of them or are you more on book shows and that sort of thing?
Later, I did get past at some clubs, but early on, again, the idea of hanging out and at a club and you know, which people are like, oh, you got to hang out, you got to hang out, you know, and I was just like, no, I found it much easier to do what were called alt shows, but what were really bar shows, where it would be a weekly show, you go once, you'd sit in the audience, you'd hang out, and you'd say, hey, you know, I'd love to do the show sometime, and usually you'd email them, and like a month or two later, they'd put you on, and again, some of the people there were doing, you know, alternative comedy, different types of things. And the rest of us were just stand-up comedians who just couldn't get on at clubs. And so we were doing just regular comedy, but in bars and at produced shows. Years and years in, I got past at the Comic Strip. And then it was really only, I sort of, you know, backwards my way into a lot of these places where I was doing it long enough and I met enough people where without hanging out, but there's still not many clubs in New York that book me regularly. I did get past to the Comedy Cellar a couple of years ago, which was exciting. And I occasionally will go on there, which is awesome.
Fun. What do you mean by
it means
passed.
You're a regular at the club. So you passed your audition and you can.
I never got past at a single club.
Me either.
I did stand up for like 15 years. There was not a single club that once ever passed me.
I have passed, but then so many times when I've passed the audition, 6 months later, the booker changes and then you're on the out again. So it's all really a crapshoot. And even the places where I have passed an audition, half the time they stop emailing me the avails. You know, I don't even know what's going on. So I've somehow managed to cobble together. And to be fair, I mean, like to me, You know, I've always been a writer primarily, and I've never fully devoted myself to the stand-up lifestyle of like, okay, I'm going to go out 7 nights a week, pound the pavement. It's interesting. I thought of something, Goldie, you said. I listened to the Seth episode, and you were talking about how as a writer, it's hard. I'm paraphrasing, but it's hard to develop your voice as a comedian because you're so used to writing for other people that you never really finalize a single voice because you're used to writing for other people. And
makes sense.
I found that as well. And I guess the only difference between you and me is I didn't let not developing a voice stop me from continuing to perform. So I'm still performing to this day, even
full
though it never really happened for me. So,
well,
yeah.
You talk about this at the beginning of your special, really, is you say, you know, I could get up here and I want to talk about myself emotionally, but it doesn't work. Right. And that it's, you know, I always just found that there were people who started with money in the bank with the audience, like a Mike Birbiglia, like you would get on stage and the audience would have some kind of ownership over him and want to make sure he had a good experience up there. And like,
yeah,
you know, like women in particular were like, you know, oh, he's wonderful. Whereas like no one ever thought I was wonderful upon seeing me. It was like, okay, that joke was funny. I'll give it to you. Well, that joke wasn't funny. I won't give
you
it to you.
It.
You know,
right.
Like,
right. It's joke by joke fighting.
Yeah. And I think we're the sort of fighting in Fallujah. You know, comedy where it's like, it's fucking block to block, man.
Yeah. House to house.
Yeah.
I don't know how to take the city at once.
No, I mean, I'm a joke teller as well. And the best I can do is sort of group a bunch of jokes together that sort of make sense together into a block of material about a topic. And, you know, I've been doing it 20 some years. And in that, I've probably have 12 or 14 years of experience spread out over 20 some years. And so, you know, eventually by that 10,000 hours, you sort of get
thinking that
good enough where you know, can get by. And I tend to.
Have you tried experimenting with the more performative aspects and approaching it that way? Or did you never take acting classes and stage craft and that sort of thing?
Never did. I sort of really. That was the other thing about my early time in New York is, you know, I really started right before the time where you could do everything, where somebody like Nick Kroll was doing stand up and UCB, you know, and also people were like Aziz and Pete Holmes were doing stand up and also shooting and editing videos. You know, I never really got into any of that. I was stand up and then I was TV jobs, which later became writing jobs. But so I never really experimented too much with the performing aspect of it. Now, that said, you know, for a 5-minute set on TV, I hammered it enough times where I go, okay, like here is a hand motion that works. Here's a body contortion that works. Here is, you know, here's a thing that, you know, you can sort of now over an hour, you know, a guy telling jokes can be exhausting and you've watched my special, so I don't know, but there are some people who, oh, they're great over an hour, but boiling it down to 5 is tough. Now for me, 5 is a perfect amount. I can crush in 5.
Yeah.
60 is where it gets to be a problem. And that, you know, but,
I got to ask you a question about specifically about stand up on TV and specifically about specials. I'm just curious whether this came up with you. So I was on, you know, I did Premium Blend. I did, I think one I did Kimmel. I think I did Kilbourne. What goes into the shirt choice for these? And how much did you agonize over it? And how much time did you spend in stores trying out looks and jackets for just that appearance?
Now, this is a great question. And the answer is this time I cheated. Because if you look back at my Premium Blend, I remember I brought, they asked you to bring 2 shirts. And I brought like a black kind of club shirt. And then there was somebody else in my episode. I think it was Brett Ernst who said he was also wearing a black shirt. Or maybe the other two guys were also wearing black shirts. They said, could you wear your backup? And my backup was a bright green button down that I bought in London, like on the street. And it was awful. It was way too big for me. And it's humiliating. The Ferguson set that I did in 2013, the outfit was okay for the time. It's like a blazer and a shirt. It's, but I... It looks ridiculous now. Now, with Seth, I have access to the wardrobe department.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they dress me, and they've dressed me for one in sketches. And this time they really helped me out. That now the last time I did Seth, Seth was still wearing a suit. And so I decided to wear a blazer and a shirt to sort of dress up for the show. Now Seth dresses casually on the show. And so I just wore what we now call a shacket, which is a shirt jacket with a T-shirt.
Oh, I thought that was the Shaquille O'Neal jacket.
They'll retire that jacket.
Yeah, exactly. It goes to my ankles.
Yeah, 32% joke percentage.
Yeah. I mean, between my wife and the wardrobe department, I do an okay job of not looking embarrassed.
Gave her a shout out.
And if you watch my Craig Ferguson set, I really am holding the microphone right here the whole time, and I cannot bear to watch it to this day because of that. And so now I'm constantly, whenever I'm on TV, I'm constantly making sure that the mic is at the right spot.
Yeah, that's how you learn, though.
That's wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a question, because we like to, you know, on some episodes, we watch a particular episode of television that we like, a pilot. We watch Frasier, you know, we watch Friends. We like to point out jokes that we think are spotlight worthy. Like, hey, that's a really funny joke. So I was hoping that we could prod you, because I thought your opening joke of this special was fantastic. So,
thank you.
I was wondering if we could get you to repeat that joke on the for our listeners now about the books. That was so funny to me. And I was just as I watched it, I was like, that's just a great joke.
So thank you. Yes. Well, so that came from literally, I think it started as a tweet, which is how a lot of my stand-up jokes came back when Twitter, you know, was something. Yeah. And, you know, but there was a period of time, a long period of time, several years, where I was basically using Twitter as my comedy notebook. And it was sort of a premise that would hit, you know, or gain some traction, and then you would sort of maybe develop it or add a punchline on stage. Yeah, so the idea being that, you know, that the idea of books being banned in schools is crazy. And when I was a kid in school, if there was a book they did not want us to read, they would just assign it to us.
that's great.
And then we wouldn't read it. And when you hit on something that is that simple, that where you go, part of you is going, somebody had to have said that, right? It was the easiest, most simple thought I've ever had. And then when you realize you're the only one, and then you can kind of build a couple of tags onto it. One being, you know, I didn't even know To Kill a Mockingbird was making me too woke. I never made it past the first 10 pages.
Right.
And that's an interesting line, because I will tweak that, because if I'm in front of a more, not conservative, but like working class, you know, clubby audience, I will say, I didn't even know To Kill a Mockingbird was making me too woke. I never made it past the first 10 pages. And now if I'm in front of a more liberal you know, progressive audience, I will put air quotes around woke. So I will say, I didn't even know To Kill a Mockingbird was like making me too woke or whatever. I never made it past the first 10 pages. And then there's another tag, which probably started literally as just something I improvise on stage, which is to say, I don't even know if To Kill a Mockingbird is the right book for that joke. I never finished it.
Right. Yes.
I'm going to give you a tag.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a test, another Brilliant. Tag for this.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
now that the special's
done, I haven't read it. I assume the mockingbird died at the end.
That's good.
That's super Goldie.
That's good. Now,
give that away in the title.
Is that something that is true about your life? Because that also resonated with me when you're like, I don't know, I didn't finish it. I had that feeling like, oh yeah, all these great classics that we were assigned, like a lot of them I did not finish.
You do look like a guy who finished it, though.
I know you do.
No, I mean, look, people will say that. People have commented that in YouTube, go, yeah, you don't look like the guys. And it is interesting, because they do say, play to the top of your intelligence, right, as a comedian. So they say, if you look like a guy who's literate, who reads a lot of books. Now, I have two sides to me, which is, yes, I was a goody-goody in high school. I got good grades. I tried to do the work. I also have, since my first child was born 9 years ago, I've probably finished like six books. I mean, I just don't read. And I probably did finish To Kill a Mockingbird. Couldn't remember what it was about. Certainly read books for fun in high school, but there were definitely tons of books in high school where you get like 50 pages in and you go, this is boring as fuck. I'm never going to finish this. Like Return of the Native, I remember being assigned. Like, I don't even know what this is. Like, why do they have me reading this? Now, To Kill a Mockingbird just happens to be, I tried The Great Gatsby there. Didn't quite work. I finished Gatsby To Kill a Mockingbird. I did finish it. It's been 30 years and I couldn't tell you why it's called To Kill a Mockingbird. To this day, I have no idea why that's the title.
I want to lead you into this because you then segued to a great joke about movies and Song of the South. Do you want to just...
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I like to comment on what's going on in the world, and I find that like absurdity or is a good way in because you're not alienating anybody. You know, you're not, I don't want, you also don't want to come. I mean, it's people who watch closely know where I stand on things, but you don't want to come off as preachy. Right. And so, you know, I just thought it was hilarious that Disney World was getting rid of Splash Mountain because it's based on Song of the South, a racist movie. And it's like, oh no, now my kids can't watch their favorite movie, Song of the South, anymore. That's canceled. As if anybody wants to watch Song of the... you know, because it is the kind of thing where conservatives would complain, like, oh, you can't say anything anymore. It's really... Oh, really? You can't do this? And it's like, nobody's... It is the one where, like, nobody was fighting for Song of the South. Like, nobody was like, no, our, no, really? My childhood classic? You're taking it away?
Also, I don't know who even knew Splash Mountain was at all related to Song of the South. I mean, you'd have to, you're not walking around Disneyland with an almanac when you're
No.
Well, the special is very funny. I also like how you it's very much my kind of joke, which is that you had a great 9/12 after 9/11.
Yeah.
You had a really good 9/12, which
that that was the page program that happened in the page program.
I was thinking that when you said that earlier. Yeah, that's funny. And so you alluded to the fact that, you know, you've been doing stand up for a number of years, maybe not the seven nights a week thing, but this I read about you, and the internet never lies, that you were voted one of the top five college comedians when you were coming out of Brown. So was that something like, how did that happen, and what did that do for you?
It happened because of a total fluke inside move. So I had a friend who is now actually a big writer director in Hollywood named Jared Stern, who has written a lot of movies and wrote and directed the DC Super Pets movie. He does a lot in animation.
I just watched that last night. It was very good.
It's good. I went to see it. I've seen it twice with my kid. So he did some stand up with us at Brown. He was a couple years older than me, and then he went to go work for this, like, you know, one of these startup websites. And they said, and he told me, we're going to tour the country, we're going to go around to different campuses, and we're going to have comedians, college kids, audition. And we got a deal where the five funniest are going to go to the Aspen Comedy Festival, which at the time was huge, with Montreal, the big comedy festival.
Yeah.
So now I think, my understanding of it is, we were the only people that knew he was coming to campus, that knew they were coming to campus. And so we, when they came, we had, you know, 8-10 comedians out on the quad ready with their like 5 minutes. I think the other people, you know, places, they were just sort of showing up, like haranguing strangers off of the street and trying to get them to perform. So it ended up that three of the five comedians who went to the Aspen Comedy Festival were named the five funniest, were from our school, because they literally had no other choices. Now, the other two, I think the other two are people that you guys both know.
Oh.
One was Nick Wegener.
No.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Who I don't think really ever did much stand-up, but really did use it to springboard into writing and animation.
Yeah. Oh, I love him.
And then the other, who ended up being the winner, was Dan Levy. Not Dan Levy, but Dan Levy, who was 20 and was already like doing professional comedy Boston at the time.
Oh,
he had, you know,
Dan
spiky
Levy
hair. Yeah, right. And he came and he was like, I mean, you can imagine what it's like to show up at this festival And immediately there's like a much more polished version of yourself. And you're sort of like, oh, fuck, I have no shot. Like, this is really, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, I don't know what the, but very early on, I mean, he got like a, you know, a hosting deal at MTV. He was sort of very hot. And I sort of, honestly, thank God nothing really came of this for me because literally I'm going to the Aspen Comedy Festival. I'm doing comedy for like the eighth time in my life in front of all these like network.
Did you know them from Brown? Did you say they both went
No,
to
they
Brown
were the two non-Brown people. The two people from Brown were people who I don't think either of them really does stand up anymore. Okay. One of them actually, this woman might be, I've seen her. I found her online. She's a therapist of some kind. And I think she was on Red Table Talk with Will and Jada. She may be the most famous of any of us at this point.
Wow.
So, you know, I went there and I had no idea what I was doing. I opened with a new joke. You know, was just so green and, you know,
cool,
I think there may have been people a couple agents gave me their card. And
did they fly you out or did you have to pay your own way?
Yeah, they flew us out. They put us up. I mean, it was insane. I mean,
that's cool.
You know, and I mean, part of the excitement was I remember, you know, you'd go to a party and Steve Martin was there or something like that, or you'd go to, and you're just trying to blend in and not
famously, you know, famously friendly Steve Martin.
Yes. or just getting to, you know, I had like an artist pass. So, I mean, you get to walk in and see any show you want, you know, and go, and
seems
that was
worth
fun,
it.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So funny. Cause I went the year I went, I don't want to, I could go on for half an hour about this, but so I saw the show that Mindy Kaling became famous from, which was this Matt Damon, Ben Affleck thing she did with a partner.
Yes.
And I was watching this and I was like, this is just awful. Not good at all. And I was like, I don't think these people have a future. And then the one thing that I was like, this is amazing, was a documentary about prison football I somehow watched. And I was like, this is going to be huge.
Yeah.
So you nailed it.
Yeah. It just was like my barometer for what was good and what were. And I mean, this is like throughout my career. It's like I have no, with no degree of accuracy, can I predict what people will, other than me, will like.
No, I'll tell you a story. I mean, when I started at Ellen, I was sharing an office with a writer who had started 2 weeks before me, and I had come from Letterman, and it was his first writing job. Mm. And I remember thinking, this guy's so green. He's never going to make it. It's not going to happen for him. I feel bad for him. And 6 months later, I was fired. And he made it to the very end of Ellen as the head writer. So, I mean, again, shows you what I know, right?
Right. Like, right.
Yeah. And as a super nice,
super
funny
guy.
Can I just
underline, yeah, shows you what I know could be the title for the next special.
That's a good title. Now, Matt, did you, was there a moment in your stand-up career where all of a sudden you found yourself sharing a bill with somebody really exciting and you were like, holy shit, I can't believe I'm on the same show as X?
There were a couple of unbilled ones. One, I remember being at Stand Up New York many years ago and I was about to go on stage. And again, this is like one of these clubs where I never was really in, but I would do, somehow you'd meet a guy who produced a show there and then you'd get on his lineup.
I know Tim Davis.
Yeah, exactly. and I was about to go on and Robin Williams walked in.
Oh,
and he had a 6-inch Subway sub that he, in his hand.
Oh, probably.
and they said, do you want to go on next? And he said, no, I'm gonna eat my sub, and I'll, why don't you have the next guy go on and then I'll go on. And thank God,
because thank God.
I went on, and that, you know, imagine having to go on after him doing like an hour and a half of like, you know,
jokes.
What he does.
put it this way, I will say, with Rob, I mean, the crowd work was brilliant. The written material,
yeah, but, somebody
I saw
else's.
Him live once, and I thought it was the best comedy experience
I ever had. I mean, it's insane. I mean, it was wild to watch, and thank God I didn't have to go on after it.
Yeah,
And then I had another one, again, another club where I was not really in too much, but I would do late night at the Comic Strip, and I remember I was about to go on. I was the last person on late night at like 1 a.m. and there were maybe 4 or 5 people in the audience. And then Chappelle walked in, and this was in the time when he was, had just basically gotten back from, he had left the Chappelle show, went to Africa and came back and was sort of now just dipping his toe back in the water. And I think I watched him do like 3 hours to like 4 people at 1 a.m.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Which is one of the things where, again, like one in the morning, I turned into a pumpkin, but yeah. Right. I was like, I have to stay for this. So that was wild. One thing I never really got to do was like opening for a big comic until during the strike. Through a friend, I did get to open for David Spade at a casino in Niagara Falls, which was like by far the biggest show I've ever did, you know, probably 3,000 people. And it was great. I mean, he's so funny, and it was an awesome show and a really fun experience. So that's cool.
That's great. You know, nice. It's funny. A couple of things come up when you were telling this story, especially about the Robin Williams thing. We have a friend named Kevin Biggins, who's a very funny. Yeah, you know him. Funny writer and comedian. And so he was just starting to do comedy, and he invited a bunch of us from work, I guess, to go see him out here in LA. I forget which club it was, but one of the two big ones here. And it was a bringer show. It was his bringer show so we were, you know, in the crowd for him.
That's nice.
And we had this lineup card of who was going to be on, and like Kevin Biggins was next, and we're all kind of getting excited. And at that exact moment, Louis C.K. showed up. And came on right before Biggins. So he had the experience that you were dreading, where Louis C.K. got up there.
And this was before Louis C.K. was to be loathed.
Right.
Right. Yeah. This was when he was absolutely revered at the top of his game. He came out, did at least a half an hour, was fucking hilarious. Probably. And then our poor buddy Kevin had to go up right after. So that was its own form of comedy for the rest of us who enjoyed watching him squirm. But the other thing you brought up about Stand Up New York, and it's interesting because it also involves Robin Williams, was our friend John Viner used to, I think he was passed at Stand Up New York when I certainly wasn't. And so he sort of had an inside track there. And he told me, hey, come to Stand Up New York tonight. I think there's going to be a cool show. And so what was happening was, this was 97, I think. It was when Comic Relief was still a thing. And so Comic Relief was being recorded the next day. And so a bunch of the comics from Comic Relief came to Stand Up New York to perform. So it was just one after the other. And it was great because it really built, you know, it started with like Caroline Ray, who, you know, we all recognize and is like this known comedic quantity. And she was hilarious. And then out comes Chris Rock, and he's hilarious. Ray Romano follows him, is unbelievable. And then Robin Williams. And like Goldie says, like I have a mixed thing with Robin Williams because I think I loved him as a kid. And then as I got to be like a cynical 20 something, I was kind of like, this guy sucks. But then seeing him do that stand up for an hour, I totally agree with Goldie. I think it was the best experience I've ever had watching stand up. Wow. And, you know, Goldie and I started doing stand up in that era where we went to the shittiest club in New York, this place Gladys's. And that's where we were regulars, and we had to bark in Times Square. But one of the people that would come there just to work his shit out every week was Jim Gaffigan. And it was before he had really exploded, but he was on the verge. And you talk about earlier, you know, you try to write a few jokes and kind of tie them together. I don't think there's anyone better at that than Gaffigan. Like he used to come and do 12 minutes about bottled water,
right?
You know, and it all just worked so well. So were there people when you were developing as a comic where you looked at them and said, I want to be like that?
I still don't have the patience for what Gaffigan does, where you go, you sit down, it's like, let me write every single thing I think of about bottled water. For me, it's like, let me coincidentally think about 3 different jokes about bottled water and then somehow Frankenstein them together into like a chunk. But I've never had that ability. I mean, when I was starting out, you know, I liked everything. I mean, I loved the one-liner guys. You know, I loved Dimitri. For sure loved Jeselnik, who I later got to write for. I knew early on I was not going to be like a Marc Maron, Janine sort of political or talking about, you know, personal, you know, I was a joke person. And I mean, the person who I look to who really inspires me today more than anything is Roy Wood Jr., who I think is so amazing, who is
funny.
I mean, I just think his jokes are incredible. There are so many, I've taken a little bit from a lot of people, you know, but I've also, I mean, you know, watching Mulaney is incredible. You guys have had him on. I listened to that episode, you know,
he begged to be on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he was sort of the one where you go, when I look at someone like Nick Kroll, I'm like, oh, I can't do characters, so I could never do that. I can't do voices, so I could never do that. But with Mulaney, you're like, oh, maybe I could do that. And then you're like, no, I can't.
I mean, I went back and watched his stuff, all of it again. And I mean, some of the premises are just incredible.
Yeah.
The thing about you'd have a school assembly. He does a whole thing about school assemblies. And then he's like, and then you would have an assembly the next day about your behavior at the first assembly, which was like, oh my God. Like,
yeah,
I never noticed that. He's absolutely right. And then he had the full rigmarole on that. And then,
yeah.
And now, hello. They bring Steve Martin up on stage. And in the moment, he's out-dueling Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, for
like,
sure.
He's a wizard. Yeah.
He is. Yeah. He is. I mean, that I show people who don't know Mulaney, I show them that salt and pepper diner bit where he and his friend put on Tom Jones, What's New Pussycat, like 15 times in a row on the jukebox. I just find that to be a hysterical bit. Yeah, he's great. You're right though, like and I felt the same way. I had the realization, I feel like you were sort of on the precipice of this, but you resisted, where I did stand up for 3 years and I had the realization, like, I'm not a stand up, I'm a writer. And the sooner I can get out of this and do that, the better. So what keeps you going with stand up? Because you are a successful writer, like you really don't have the need to do it, but you must have some kind of internal drive that keeps you going.
I think when you're on stage, that there's nothing, sometimes you can get a real high from watching your material do well on TV, for sure. The feeling of being on stage and doing well, is that's what keeps you going, really. I mean, all this stuff, emailing to get spots or trying to track down, or, you know. I also really do, I mean, and this is part of what was so exciting coming back from the pandemic, I really do like going out and watching comedy. I like seeing it live. I feel like as somebody who just released a special, I feel like filmed stand-up does not convey how fun it is to watch comedy.
Right.
I do really enjoy seeing shows. I mean, but then the other thing is, you know, I've always had these late night writing jobs where you're writing things week to week or day to day. And then the normal thing that a person will be doing on the side would be writing scripts, writing pilots, writing script. That's the kind of stuff that I've always found very, very difficult. And so, for instance, writing a screenplay or writing a pilot where nobody's agreed to pay for it or even read it, and you're just doing it on spec in the hopes it may lead to something. So for me to keep busy during the non-time, the hiatuses and the times when I'm not as busy at work, the stand-up has always been the easiest thing to do to fill the hole. It's the one thing I sort of know how to do. Right. And so because of that, I probably, honestly, there were years I probably should have been writing a screenplay instead of going and doing bar shows, you know, or whatever. Right. But for whatever reason, it became the main side gig, the main side piece, if you will.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And now we've mentioned it a few times. I think we should mention the title. Your comedy special is called No Questions Asked. And it is on YouTube. Is it anywhere else that people can find it, or should they look on YouTube?
They can find it on fucking YouTube, dude.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean anywhere else?
I'm just saying
YouTube. Like, it's everywhere.
I'm saying some people are more comfortable on the streamers. Don't give me that face. Well, you don't know Boston either. Yeah. You gave me a face.
Is there anywhere else people should be getting their air?
There will be an album. There will be an album version that comes out on March 8th. I don't know if this will be out, but that'll be on all of the audio platforms as well as hopefully SiriusXM. My last album, I did record one other album, which still gets a lot of play on SiriusXM. That was in 2017. And then the plan for this one was to record another album. I got a deal to record an album. About 3 weeks beforehand, we decided, well, we are going to have the audience there anyway. Why not bring in cameras? Why not film it and self-release it? They tell me that a lot of comedians do this anyway now. They release their specials on YouTube rather than, I mean, I think unless you can sell to Netflix or one of the big, big streamers, you know, you can sort of sell to these other places that platform your, you know, but I mean, you know, big comedians have had things on YouTube. I wish I could say I made the choice actively to be like them, but really it was more just, it was the easiest thing and the only thing we did. And I've been very pleased. I really, honestly, I knew people would see the Seth set because, you know, obviously Late Night with Seth Meyers has millions of YouTube followers. They, you know, they tweet things out from their accounts. And so I knew people would see that. I did not really have any expectation that anyone would watch the special.
Right.
And somehow people have. And, you know, again, it's not doing like Matt Rife numbers, but it is, but it's, you know, people have watched it and people said very nice things. And it's been very, pleasing. It's been, you know, very rewarding. So,
yeah. Good. Well, hey, great answer. Glad I asked.
Yes.
And Goldie, you gave me a look earlier when I said we don't know Boston, like, oh, I know Boston. You don't know Boston.
What's happening?
I don't know Boston.
Yeah, see, I knew it, but you gave me a look.
This
Why?
Was so long ago.
I mean, how do you know? We're on a Zoom. I was looking at JC. You don't know what I'm looking.
You were looking at. It was a direct response to. I think Goldie and I don't know Boston the same way you were like.
You went.
I'm a fan of the show, and I really don't want to be known as the episode that rips you guys apart.
Oh, no. Trust me.
This happens weekly.
All right. Okay.
W-E-A-K-L-Y. So
where else are you getting your water besides the sink?
Oh, here we go. Yeah, a bottle like you brought up last week. So, okay. Now, let's not do this in front
of YouTube.
Let's talk a little bit about Ellen, because obviously, you know, much has been made of Ellen. Ellen, you know, was a huge daytime presence, the biggest for years. Did they have stand-ups come on Ellen?
Did you look at her?
No. I gotta say, I will say, coming from Letterman, I did have multiple meetings with Ellen every day. So I want that on the record.
And that's
actually funny because, you know, this is a story I've told before, but and I can't believe I forgot to mention this, but you know, obviously all the stuff came out about Ellen being a toxic work environment. People asked me whether it was toxic. Now I had come from working there at Letterman where Letterman, if you remember, went on the air and admitted that he had had an affair with a member of his staff. That was on a Thursday. Friday, the next day, was a rerun. And on the following Monday, he went out and did a whole monologue about his scandal. And that was my first day as a writer at Letterman.
Oh, my God.
So, wow.
Did you have to pitch?
Yeah.
Did you have to pitch on here's a funny way to say you were blackmailed?
No, all my jokes were about like Obama and stuff, and then people were like, wow, that monologue was brilliant, did you write it? And then I was like, no, I didn't write any jokes about the boss's sex scandal on my first day. And the head writer said, hey, we're not going to do any more jokes on that after today. And I said, good, because I wasn't going to write any. Compared to that, I mean, if you ask me if Ellen was toxic compared to that, no, it wasn't. That was crazy. Like, it can't, right. You know, so I mean, but
well,
I
did you start early on in Ellen's tenure
no,
there?
No, I was there. They've been on for maybe nine years.
Wow.
And it was,
okay.
I mean, I'm just going to take the high road, which is 100% completely true, and say that it was not a good fit for me. I really was not the right kind of writer for that show. I think that they hired me. I maybe, you know, submitted a packet that they liked, and I had come from Letterman, and for sure I knew Ellen's stand-up and loved her stand-up.
Yeah, she's funny.
But I had barely ever watched her daytime talk show.
I bet in her mind she would read a packet like yours and go like, "This is what we should be doing. I want to be funny. I want," and then immediately would do one, and it wouldn't quite go over because it's daytime and it's the morning, audience and it's different. And then it would be like, "What are we doing with this guy?" Like,
I remember getting there. This is what I remember, which was getting the packet emailed to me, and then they said, and be like, "Oh, I have to write a packet for the show, so I got to watch the show." So I watched the show, and they did do a bit that day about, it was when the Chilean miners were trapped underground.
Yes.
And so I was like, I was like, "Oh, it's a topical late night show that happens to be on during the day." And I think that stuck in my head. And then I realized much later, like after I've been there months and months of like pitching topical humor, was like, no, it's not. That was just one off, very unusual day where they did do a joke about something that was in the news, because it was like a silly, short, easy joke. And I think I kept pitching things about stuff that was in the news, and it was just, they had to be like, no, they're not. We don't talk about this. And again, like, you know, many, many things I could have done differently if I think.
Yeah, you could be pitching songs for her to dance to.
Oh my God.
And that would have worked. But it's interesting that you sort of highlight this this Letterman-Ellen comparison. Do you think that maybe like Ellen got kind of a bad rap just because of who she is more than what was actually going on? I mean, did Letterman get a pass because he's like a revered guy who had been there for years, and here's Ellen who's, you know, a woman, and oh, how dare she have attitude?
Letterman for sure got a pass. I mean, I think part of the reason might be that Letterman's on camera persona was that of a jerk.
Yes.
So
when it was revealed that he had done some unsavory things, people were not super surprised. Right. They sort of said, well, that tracks. I think that did help him. I think the sad truth, you guys have worked in a lot of places are toxic work environments. A lot of places have their problems. It's very sad. And so when this stuff comes out, people are always shocked, and I go, I think that sadly the more unusual environment is the one I have now, where everyone's really nice and it's a great place to work.
I will say that with Seth Meyers, I know that working on SNL, a place of respite for me would be to walk across the hall and go hang out with Eli and the band there and just decompress and just like, because the vibe on Seth Meyers is so friendly and laid back yet professional. Like I just, you must love working there. From top to bottom, everyone there's been, was always so kind and welcoming.
Yes. And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned Eli and Seth Jabor from the HE Band, who gave me some music that I used in my special. My walk on music and the end credits music was they wrote.
That's
performed.
So cool. Yeah. Shout out to them. I love those guys. Yeah.
All right. Well, Matt, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. We appreciate it. We love talking with you. And obviously we have a lot of things in common. So that was very fun. But is there anything coming up that you want to tell the folks about, or is it just kind of like, go watch my YouTube comedy special?
If you can find YouTube, they should.
All right. Yeah.
If you go to HTTP.
Oh, now you're joining in.
People should watch the special, and then people have asked me if I'm going to tour.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I think I'm going to retire. I don't know. I mean, it's done, right? I don't know. I mean, I might, you know, if people want me to come to their city, I'll come. I'm not going to, my wife, you know, I need to be home with my children. I can't be, but
we may need an opener when we do the podcast in Yemen. We'll call it.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Big in Yemen. No questions asked is the special. It's on YouTube, and I think subscribe to the Matt Goldich YouTube channel is the other thing.
Oh, that's great.
Yes. Like and subscribe. It really helps this channel, guys. Well, the special is very funny, so I do recommend people, our listeners, go out there and listen to it on YouTube, as pointed out. But Matt, thank you so much for being here today.
So
it was a pleasure talking to you and meeting you virtually. And best of luck going forward.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This was awesome. I'm a fan of the show, so this was great.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Oh, wow. Matt, what a nice guy.
So
fun talking to him. And we have so much in common with him. You know, it was great talking about the nightmares and the fun of stand up and late night.
Being in New York at the same time. And
Matt, funny comedy special on YouTube, as Goldie pointed out. And we love talking to him. But now let's get into a portion of the show we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Oh, we're beautiful. JC, this was you. Tell us what we're doing.
Top 5 conspiracy theories.
Wait a minute. Who put you up to this?
Okay. You know, for me, it was sort of like I didn't know what was really the order. They're all just weird. So my number 5 are chemtrails.
Overlap. Instant overlap.
Oh, shit. Yeah. So I used to work with a guy on SNL right next to me. His name was Kaz. Great guy. Convinced.
Yep.
If you were tired that day, he was like, oh, I saw a lot of the chemtrails up at Binghamton today. I'm like, what?
So explain what they are.
So when a plane releases the little jet smoke from behind its trail, people think that those are chemicals that can control the weather, mind control. It's just lots of things. And some people believe that there was a huge storm that was supposed to hit this Metallica concert in Russia. And then they used chemtrails to control the storm and push it away from this huge festival.
I love that. I love that you have that detail.
My number 4, Paul McCartney is a doppelganger.
Double overlap.
There's also one that people think Avril Lavigne is a doppelganger, but this was number 3, that the moon landing was faked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. It was.
It was. Awesome. Number 2 could have been number 1. This is so talked about, the JFK assassination, whether or not
triple
it's it.
Overlap.
I mean, and my number 1 is Flat Earth.
Yeah, you know, that one's the funniest by far.
It's like, people really believe this.
I know. It's funny because the Flat Earthers sent out a tweet that keeps getting reposted, which is so funny. It said, there are millions of Flat Earthers around the globe. Was that thing. And it was just like, you just debunked your own conspiracy in the tweet.
Amazing.
All right, Goldie, go ahead.
Number 5, COVID. And everything around it, from the origins to the vaccine.
That's a great one.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes.
Number 4, Malaysian Air Flight MH370.
Yes.
An airplane disappears.
Ooh, yes.
Where is it?
Number 3, was Michael Jordan suspended for gambling?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's a good one. I love that. Was his dad killed for it?
That's another.
Number 2, Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah, great photo. One.
I believe in Bigfoot.
What a photo.
Yeah. That looks like me when I wake up to go to the bathroom at 3 a.m. That's exactly what I'm doing. And number 1, and we've talked about this on the podcast, but everything involving UFOs, I'm on board for, and I will believe in.
Yeah.
And I really want to see one.
Area 51. Yeah, you might. You might see one.
We should go to Area 51.
Yeah, let's go storm it. Let's storm it. All right, I'll get through mine. Number 5, here, a lot of overlap with JC.
Okay.
Number 5, Paul McCartney dead.
There you go.
And I think some of the way the Beatles cheekily played into it on their Abbey Road cover.
Yes.
Where one of the license plates on the car says 28 if, which is like how old Paul would have been if he were alive. And the way they're walking across the crosswalk, Paul's the only one barefoot. And so people say, like, he's the body and that John is the priest and Paul is the digger and whatever. So I love that one.
Yeah.
Number 4, this one is hysterical to me, was do you guys remember Pizzagate?
Yes.
Yes.
That almost made my list.
What a debacle, as Kilborn would say.
People still believe that.
Well, just this whole notion that Democrats are, you know, blood drinking pedophiles and that ordering a pizza was their code for like, hey, we want to order young boys to drink their blood.
I had pizza last night.
And they believed that it was happening underneath this one specific pizza restaurant. So some crazy guy like went and stormed it. And like all that was down there was like old dough
pizza boxes. So
that was great. Number three, chemtrails. Ooh, JC, I love that. We have a similar experience. I have a very good friend from high school who never shut up about chemtrails and like totally had me believing it. And like, you know, all the Evergreen International, that company they say is kind of behind it. Number two, 9/11. 9/11 being an inside job.
Yeah.
Is a really intriguing conspiracy that I think I did believe for a while, which sort of speaks to how much I hated Bush at the time and Cheney.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we've talked about this on here. You look back at Bush as like this kind of like sweet guy, like we would kill to have him back now. But like at the time, didn't like him, didn't trust him, thought that maybe it was true. But now I think that probably the more logical truth is that it was a terrorist attack, but the U.S. cynically saw it as an opportunity to launch this like two-decade war. Okay.
Right.
And number one is JFK. You know, I think it's the one that has the most legs. And that's the one that I actually believe the most, although there is not one clear, you know, conspiracy, which makes it even more interesting because there are so many viable options. But I do believe that he was assassinated by our own government somehow.
Yeah.
Yes. That was fun. Fun thinking about conspiracy theories. Fun feeling crazy for a little while or more crazy. So next week is my top five. I think I want to do top five songs that are better than the movie they're in.
Ooh.
Ugh, it sounds like so much work.
No, you could probably Google that phrase, Goldie, and it'd be fine.
Yeah.
All right. So that'll be next week. And we usually end the show on a high note. We haven't been recently, and I think it's been kind of freeing for us.
Yeah. I actually haven't heard anything that anyone missed.
No. unless they're going they're getting angry in Yemen. We'll have to wait to see how Yemen feels about
Listen,
it.
Listen, I'll just say briefly, I'm loving the rain. It's just guilt-free showers, and another month we're not going to die in a fire.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's a good one.
That can encompass all of our high notes.
Yes, thank you.
So, yeah, fun show today. Thank you, too, as always, for being awesome. Thank all of you for listening, and we will talk to you again next week.
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
The security you want.
This happens weekly. WEAKLY.